you know, we see the flood story show up so many different times in so many different cultures. Is there stuff like that that you bumped up against, which is so universal? Like, what are the most universal stories in folklore?
I think the mention of flood certainly is that. The figure of Thor, for example, you find in the Indian Indra.
It's a beautiful poetic way to think about the fact that we share these stories and to get over our tribalism. Do you have any insights or thoughts about why we could come up or share stories across such different cultures and across such different timelines in such different regions?
So there's an element of humanity, shared humanity, which could bind us a little bit better than it does. And especially with climate change at the moment, there's a particular reason for underlining shared humanity. Compared to the gods we talked about at the beginning, we're very small little creatures.
That moment of near disaster.
And with difficulty kept my
course. It was for us the pleasure of discovering.
Icelanders are known for being incredible storytellers, so they drink cod liver oil and they tell good stories and they live by the sea. But that thing about storytelling is how we actually, because you're a folklorist, am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this tradition of storytelling goes all the way back to first arrival on the islands. But really what blew my mind was how impactful that is to the rest of the world today. Like the things that we take for granted today, the stories in Harry Potter or in Lord of the Rings or in Jules Verne are somehow, you know, they've had influences from Icelandic sagas and myths, which is what you're a world leading expert. How do you become a world expert in ancient folklore and storytelling of Iceland? What drove you? Like, what inspired you? Was there a moment?
I've always been interested in history and the way that landscape tends to have stories associated with it. When I grew up in Brighton, there was a place just up the road called the Devil's Dyke. And the Devil's Dyke was a big valley which sort of suddenly stopped. On the other side of the hill, where it suddenly stopped is we're heading down towards the sea. And the idea was that the devil was digging a dike between the land heading up towards London and then the sea in the south. And there was an old lady who noticed that he was doing this. And she brought out a lantern, which he thought was the sun coming up, and that made him run away and stop. That's why he stopped digging the dike. So it was to explain the landscape. I also grew up hearing stories of thunder and lightning. My parents, I think, would talk about it being thought down there as well. And Sussex, mm-hmm. where I came from, is full of stories of this kind. So I was always interested in that kind of thing, always interested in the past. And gradually, as I became more and more associated with Scandinavia, first through Norway, where I was working one summer just before university when I met my wife from Iceland there, also working in the same place. So going from Norway into Iceland, I've always been interested in the stories that are associated with these places. I was doing lectures for American tourists in Norway, which were attempting to bring to life the landscape around them, underlining that if you listen carefully, you get a sense of the way that the Vikings understood this landscape and how people understood the landscape in the 1800s and 1900s in the past. So you walk around the landscape and you hear voices.
But when you bring up a really interesting kind of also second point, was that when you listen carefully, you can not only understand the Vikings, but you can, just in the conversations you have with other Icelanders, hear the ancient words, right? I mean, is modern day Icelandic essentially the old Viking language?
Yes, it is. It's hardly changed. Icelanders can, at school, they all have to read the sagas and the Eddic poems, and they can understand it. It's a little bit difficult, but it's not. It's probably easier than for us reading Shakespeare. It's certainly a lot, much, much easier than for any of us trying to read Chaucer, for example. So it's the past is there. They can still understand the voices of the past, yes.
And when you speak to your wife, are you like doing research on ancient sounds then?
The thing is, my background's in drama, and all narratives for me are narratives that are not written in ink. They're something that you experience, that you experience. They're spoken in a particular environment at a particular time by a particular person, and they're a matter of sound. So for me, the landscape contains echoes of earlier voices, in a sense. And certainly I always think of these stories in terms of voices that are spoken rather than ink on paper. And that's the way that they were initially. They weren't read, they were experienced in time and space.
Yeah, the last time I saw you, we were in a little turf hut, a replica of an ancient home of the early Icelanders. I think I just witnessed my first Northern Light experience the night before in the freezing cold. By the way, did you just see, you guys just, I mean, we all just, the globe had a G5 solar storm a couple of weeks ago. Did you experience
that? Right, you guys had it. We had cloud. We've had cloud for the last few days, so we didn't get any of this. They were all sent on to you.
But I had just experienced that, and I find myself in a little turf hut with you, listening to you retell the stories of the ancient sagas. Or even before the sagas, the origin stories, the origin myths of the Norse, and then you told me something that kind of just shocked me, which was you put together the pieces where I realized that even the stories of Odin and Thor that you take for granted in, you know, modern day Marvel films as these epic tales that have come to life in modern day storytelling, or the giants in modern day stories like Harry Potter and things like that, you know, the trolls, the elves, all these different things, they were essentially written down as parts of Icelandic folklore, but for the first time in these ancient sagas, right? So those stories that affect us today, that have affected the whole planet, originated in Iceland. Why is that? Why is Iceland like this cauldron of magic? What is it? Is it the auroras? What do you think? What is happening?
Now, the Icelanders were known from the beginning as being very good storytellers, and it's partly because they're an immigrant race. We can put it that way. And I think the same applies, of course, to Americans. But most people have memories of, well, they'll talk about where their ancestors came from and feel it important to go back maybe to the country where their ancestors came from. So Icelanders were very much like that too. They'd left home in Norway, especially in Western Norway, and slaves, they'd left home in the north of, in north of Scotland and Ireland. And they all brought with them a sense of identity, and the stories, in a sense, underline their identity, where they came from, and then how their ancestors settled this landscape, which had no place names. It had no history when they came here. It was a complete blank page, except for a few slightly mad hermits from Ireland who were hanging around and disappeared quite quickly. But it was a completely empty space, something that we can't imagine. Wow. Yeah, there was no indigenous population. There's a few Arctic foxes, that was it, and a few birds. Walruses and seals and sea beings, yes. So it was a paradise in that sense for hunters. This is in about 870. About 817.
So 817. Okay, let's try to put ourselves in the mindset of an arrival. 817, I'm on a what would be now described as a Viking ship. Is that right?
Yeah. Right. 870. And I'm
870, and I'm showing up. I'm sailing. What am I looking for? Why am I even out there? Why am I sailing into this direction?
Because it's the initial people. The Icelanders like to say in their sagas that they were fleeing tyranny from the first king of Norway, who was taking over the entire country for himself and getting rid of local kingships and local clans. That's one they of their stories. Is that they were fleeing. They were saying, well, into the nothing they knew. people had, they knew that the birds, they saw the birds flying north out over the sea. And if the birds are flying north, they must be flying somewhere. That's what they're following initially. With one day trip, they can get to Shetland if the weather behaves itself. And that's north of Scotland. From there, they'll do another maybe 1.5 days to the Faroe Islands, and they can still see birds going further north. So then they'll go on, and then they come to Iceland. And in the same way that they went on to Greenland and America later on. So there's an element of exploration. Wow. Many of them wouldn't have made it. And then they come to this place, which has got, as I say, nobody living here before. Very unlike Scotland and England when they came there. Faroe Islands are the same. And it's a question, it smells differently, as you know yourself, the smell of sulfur when you turn on the taps in Iceland. You've got earthquakes, you've got volcanoes, you've got new lava. You believe in nature spirits, but you expect there must be nature spirits here too, but do they speak the same language that they spoke at home? And of course, you've left all of your ancestors behind. And when you're living in Norway, you had ancestors going back to the Bronze Age or even Stone Age. You've left them all behind. They're not in the landscape. You might try and bring some earth with you or some trees. There's nothing
in that sense. There's no human activity on that island back in the Bronze Age.
No, totally different to say when you come to America. No, nothing.
Wow.
So you have no idea where to bury the dead. You have... Yeah, completely, completely so. And I think we can compare it in many ways to going to the moon, except maybe they'd done a lot more exploration about the moon before they went there than with Iceland. Iceland was just – and people were coming here maybe initially, maybe were just hunting for whales, for walrus and ivory, for example, and coming back home. But then they're coming here to stay, especially when they got thrown out of Ireland, which was happening too at the same time. So it was a lot of space, a lot of quite good land. The climate was better now then than now. Sorry,
They must have run from. So it must have been horrible at home. I mean, to stand at the edge of the sea and see a horizon, that's one thing. But to decide to go out into just where the birds are going. Beyond the horizon, it's a pretty terrifying experience if you don't know what's beyond, if you've never charted any of that before. And
absolutely, yet, and especially when many people didn't come back. Yeah.
And the North Sea is a rough sea. That's a hardcore sea. That's not like some nice, hospitable, warm water. That's cold, mean, stormy stuff, right?
Yeah, very, very. You'll die in this water in about 10 minutes.
Okay, so you sail off and you land, and I'm sure there was tales of ancient, sea monsters and all these things to contend with, and that unexplainable forces. But then you find yourself on a rock that now we know today is a place where the continents pull apart, right? Where the tectonic plates pull apart. That Iceland was actually born out of the European tectonic plate and the North American tectonic plate pulling apart, creating this massive geological fury. But back then, in 870, you just show up in a weird land which is bubbling with sulfur, which has steaming rocks and earthquakes every day. That wasn't what it was like in Europe at the time, right? What's the geology of Europe like in comparison?
Well, they knew in some areas that have heard about earthquakes, they knew there are faint memories of the sun going out back in about the year 530. So there were no summers for about 3 years, but nothing of that, nothing like Iceland. So all they can do when they set off, in a sense, they call on Thor to help them. They have Thor with them. They believe that he'll help them at sea. They have these dragon shapes on the front of their ships to try and frighten away sea monsters, things of this kind. And then when you come to the land, it's a question of, well, first of all, where should you settle and they believe very strongly in ideas of fate. So many of them throw into the water the high seat pillars of their home in Norway. In a sense, they're bringing a bit of Norway with them. They're bringing trees from Norway with them in the shape of pillars, which in a sense brings a bit of home with them. They throw them into the water, and where those come to land, that's where they feel the gods feel they should live. There are also other ways of doing it. Somebody's granddad died on the way, so they threw granddad into the water to see where he wanted them to live, his coffin. But again, they're calling on higher spirits. And when they come to the land, they need to mark it out as a civilized space from the nature spirits by carrying fire around it or iron or shooting an arrow or something of this kind to bring civilization to the space. So they feel it is, again, wild when they come here. You can't build a house immediately, of course, either. You've got maybe some wood with you. That's going to take a year or so. So you're going to have to dig a hole in the ground somewhere for warmth, or maybe live in a sort of tent for the first few months until you can get a house built. It's much like the Wild West to a certain extent. In the summertime, it's warmer. Yeah, absolutely. and wintertime, awful, absolutely.
So, I was just there a couple of weeks ago with you, and it was, I got to say, San Diego, I was not prepared. I had, I was definitely needing every bit of Icelandic support I could to stay warm. But what was amazing to me was when my friend Thor showed us, right next to the town that he had lived in, which had unfortunately been destroyed by the town of Grindavik by these latest eruptions. He showed me these fields of moss, which we could stand on, and we would get warm because he just said that basically we're standing right above the lava flows. We don't know it, but we're basically being cooked by the molten lava that's coming up from the core. And so, what? I mean, we can say that we can understand that conceptually. We have the help of modern science and geoscience to be able to do that. But if you were showing up at 870 and it's freezing cold around you, and all of a sudden you get these hot springs and these steaming rocks and these lava eruptions, and you'd never seen anything like that before, I would imagine that even, then, let alone now, your understanding of the concept of nature spirits or being in a coexistence with spirits bigger than yourself would have been the predominant experience. That must have just felt like, how do you explain this outside of stories? How you create stories to explain the unexplainable. And yet when you look back at the Icelandic stories, you said those stories are an amalgamation of many stories that came together, but were those stories born from the place as well? Were new stories emerging out of this cauldron of nature and nature spirits?
We don't know, of course, how much was created in Iceland and how much was part of the sort of inheritance they brought with them. It looks like, if we're looking at the early poems, which make no mention of Christianity, Christianity comes along in about the year 1000. The sagas are written down in about 1200 later on. And you'd expect works about the old gods, especially works in which the old gods speak to you directly, and the performer of these poems is actually taking on the role of the god, bringing him alive in the room. And he says to the audience, "I hung on a tree for 9 nights with a spear in my side. I reached into the world of death and brought back the runes." The god has come alive in the room, and no Christians are going to be doing that. The last thing you want to do is bring back the pagan gods. So the likelihood is that these are poems that are very, very old, that have been passed on then maybe about 300 years. Of course, changing slightly over time, because as things do in the oral tradition, but their roots are very old.
The Norse origin stories and this pagan tradition that goes back to the very beginnings of Odin and Thor and all these other things, am I to understand it correctly that all the Norse lands, that the first recordings of these were from Iceland in the written context?
Exactly. The Icelanders are recording them. And in A History of Denmark, for example, it says at the beginning that he's called on the Icelanders because they have a memory of the old things. They're known for their memory and for their poetic work. Yeah. So they gain names for themselves as performers, as poets, and also people who remembered the past. They felt they needed to because they'd left home. The only way to keep Norway alive for them was by telling the stories. And stories do this. It's the same, as I say, in the States.
Yeah. So you have these old Norse beliefs that all arrived in this magical, mythical land, and from different places, from Scotland, Ireland, other places, they're all pushed up there. And with them, they carry this time capsule of all these ancient memories, and then they distill them into a series of books. Now, can you give me a context for how many of these books have been found? I mean, how many of these ancient writings? This is much bigger than anything that's been found elsewhere outside of Iceland, right? In the context of these ancient stories, in like in England or in Denmark, do they have anything comparable? What are we actually talking about in terms of the weight of
We have in Denmark, there's a sort of history of the Danish kings, but it's written in Latin, and it seems to preserve Nordic stories. There are similarities in what we have from Iceland, but we're not unsure about it. So the Christians are writing a few things down in Latin, but not in the original language that we have, the language in which those stories were told. So 1220, roughly, we have this guy called Snorri, Snorri Sturluson, who is aware... Snorri Sturluson.
Yeah. Sturluson.
And he's... Yeah, exactly. So he's a budding chief of Iceland. He would like to be that. He's learned. He's Christian at the same time. But he has a background of poets in his family. And he's very aware of the poetic tradition, which is still going on in Iceland. And Icelandic poets are going and working for the Norwegian kings all the time, a little bit like sort of rock stars of their own period. But he's aware that those traditions and the language that they use, which use imagery from the Old Norse pagan times, that this is beginning to get lost because of Christianity. So we need to write this down. We need to preserve it before it disappears. We need to preserve these sounds, these songs. And to do that, one thing is to write them, is to get them written down. And the other thing is to explain the stories that they're referring to. When they refer to the one-eyed Odin, for example, what do we mean he has one eye? Where does that come from? So he has to collect a background of this material. So he puts together a handbook for poets, explaining the poetic imagery. And then he's drawing on the work written by Icelandic poets or composed by Icelandic poets after the settlement of Iceland. But then he puts another book together, like the first chapter or the first section of this overall book called his Edda, which has the mythology. And in that, he's referring to even older poems that he can't think of an author for. He knows of no author. He says they're ancient. So he's referring to poems which we call the Eddic poems. And these are also recorded in another manuscript, which I'll tell you about in just a second. And it was that I was quoting for you, those poems I was quoting for you in the house when we were there. And it looks like when he put this book together, this started people thinking, yeah, we better collect now. A little bit like the Grimm's stories and so on, at the end of the rural society, we need this collected before it disappears. So we have his Edda with these references to poems. We have History of the Norwegian Kings, which he writes, where he refers to poems, which are his evidence. And then we have this wonderful two little manuscripts about this sort of size, which contain the ancient poems, and the Codex Regius, the King's Book, is one of those. And that's the one that has most of these old poems. Yes. So there's their poems about the gods on one side, and then then poems about heroes, ancient heroes who fought dragons and knew Attila the Hun and things of this kind.
This is the oldest document containing the ancient pagan belief systems. Is that right?
Exactly.
What is it called?
That's written in about 1270, and that's the Poetic Edda. The Poetic Edda.
A Song of the Sea? Is that the one?
That's one of the poems in it. So it's a collection of poems, some of which are dialogues, some of which are monologues. So the gods speak to us. I describe this manuscript as being a bit like a CD, if anybody knows what a CD still is these days. But in a sense, if you listen to it, sounds have been turned into letters, a little bit like music turned into notes. To get it written down and preserved. So it's been transformed from sound. But in a sense, if you listen to that manuscript, it's got sounds contained in it. A little bit like a CD has. The beginning of the poem Völuspá describes this time when there was nothing. So, Ár var alda þar ími byggði, var nýr sandur, nýr sæð, nýr svala unnir. Jörð veitum aldrei gapfaginunga en grass quergi. So this is just describing the nothingness that was there. There was no grass, there was nothing, there was just space. Before the gods killed this giant-like figure and then made the earth out of him and then introduced time and introduced space. But yeah, these poems contain sound.
Well, they can say philosophy and cosmology, and I mean, you're saying there was an idea that
they
at one
can.
Point
one of the poems, the words of the High One, contains advice for how you should behave. Don't drink too much because you'll get stupid. Never trust women; their hearts are made on a spinning wheel. Don't forget your sword when you go out. It doesn't matter too much to have lost your hand if you've still got a house. Things like this. And then a collection of runes and magic skills that Odin can do.
Going back to the origin story of the time before everything, the nothingness to the somethingness, the before time and to the after, now we have time. These are huge concepts. I mean, they're as huge as the understanding of the, you know, what is zero? What is infinity? What are these things that we take for granted now? But the early philosophers grappled with these at a very deep existential level. And yet they're in these ancient memories of what you would describe now as just a warfaring, you know, I mean, like some people look at the Viking Age and like, oh, here are a bunch of warriors, right? But what you're talking about is existential poetry. You know, like this grappling with existence.
In a sense, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. They were aware of things coming out of nothing. Of course, a child comes into being for them almost out of nothing, within the womb of a mother, and then comes out suddenly as there. You can take some rock, and you heat it up, and you produce iron, and suddenly you produce a sword. And you can take wool, and suddenly you've produced a weaving, a carving. So the people that did this, they often saw as being magicians, women especially having particular power, more than most people. So I think they have a sense, a philosophical sense of creation out of nothing, and the power of creation.
What happens after existence? In the Eddas, are there stories of what you step into after you die? What is
oh yes, well that's there too, but I'll come on to that in just a second. So the what happens in that poem is that the gods create the earth, male gods create the world out of a sort of giant figure, and the clouds are his brain, for example, the rivers are his blood, and things of this kind. So they create, and then, like idiots, they start time off as well, and they put the stars in the right positions, they create constellations. But as soon as you create time, of course, you're suddenly three women come in from outside that they never created. They can't work out where they've come from. They don't remember creating women. And these women come in, and they are almost certainly the fates. because they've started the clock. And if you start the clock, it's going to keep going, and eventually the bell's going to ring, in a sense. And the end is set right from the beginning, and they try to deal with all of these things. And then the end of the world comes about with Ragnarok, as they all fight each other, and the world burns up, and the world tree collapses, the stars fall out of the sky, and we go back, and the world sinks into the sea again. And then in that poem, another world comes afterwards. Now, in terms of death, definitely they believed in a life after death. We all hear about Valhalla, or which it should be Valhall. That's Valhall. A later development. Yeah, that's a later development. The hall of the chosen. In general, the world of death was a world of darkness belonging to a woman ruler, female ruler. A little bit like nature, the earth, the underworld is all in the hands of women. Because women create, but they also deal with the end. In many societies, they're dealing with the corpse at the end. But death, as they knew from nature, isn't a bad thing. Out of death comes life.
It feels like there's these strange parallels to so many other philosophies and belief systems. Like, for example, I've just been reading this book, the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, and it describes time as this kind of strange concept, you know, where it creates a beginning and an end, but actually everything's always existing at once if you really step back from a different meditative standpoint. Mm-hmm. It talks about these cycles of death and then rebirth and the sort of continuous cycle of things. And yet there's these parallels in the origin stories of the North that are seemingly more universal than we might take for granted. No, that we just keep bumping up against the same sort of questions. What's, like, does time exist? What is, like, what's before time? What's after time? What is impermanence? Like, all these, it's a thing. It's the one thing we all grapple with, right?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, in our own world, we need to slow down and just take a look at nature, take a look at a sunrise and a sunset, and actually think. It's a great thing when you go to Greece and you have a glass of wine and you watch the sunset, and you think, you can see why philosophy came up in Greece. And Native Americans have it. The Tibetans have it. An Icelandic farmer had it, was aware of the circle of the year. It's a slower lifestyle. We're moving too fast, I think.
Well, I think we've removed ourselves from the tempo or the cadence of nature, right? Like when I was with you in Iceland, it was very easy to feel where we were in the cycle of the year because we had X amount of hours a day, and they were much bigger than normal, and then the night became night and it was so cold, so intense, yet magical. I mean, the auroras, they evoke a sense of mysticism, right? And then the back end of the day, and you feel the tempo of change of the annular cycles. Nowadays, we're just, you know, we have air conditioning and light switches to just remove all of that into something more convenient that makes us maybe live a little bit better, but also forget our relationship to this one perpetual metronome of nature.
Yeah, and certainly, so I've taught courses on Native American people as well, and spoken to some of them in Albuquerque. And again, it's the to give yourself time to say something, to think something through, which I think they still have remnants of. We move far too fast, and you'll speak when you feel there's something to speak about. And this is their way. So yeah, and you've been to these places, yeah, exactly.
I mean, as a folklorist, is that the one of the big wisdoms that you've taken away from looking at ancient folklore is that we've forgotten because we're no longer at the right pace of our human conscious mind.
I think it's something that Tolkien was getting at when he writes Lord of the Rings. And if anybody reads his Tree and Leaf, where he explains exactly why he's doing what he's doing, he wants to bring back the idea of a tree having life, in a sense, to actually feel the life running through a tree. Hence a figure like Treebeard, for example. Hence the hobbits living within the earth in some way or other. Hence the Balrog and the power of the volcano, in a sense. He wants to encourage people to go back and reconsider the world like people used to do in the past. And that certainly this is what's contained within folklore. It takes you into, of course, we're creating new folklore all the time. We're creating new stories all the time. But the old material gives us, it's very different to a legal document or a historical document, which just tells us, hey, it did this at this time. This gives you an insight into the way people understood the world, the element of magic and mysticism that they experienced around them, the way that they understood the landscape, the way the landscape spoke.
What's incredible is that still today in Iceland, there's still this deep rooted belief in the unexplainable, or at least, you know, acknowledgement that there's more to the world than we can explain with science, right?
Certainly with the farmers in the countryside, yes.
Yeah, you bump into this a lot. What are, like, how does this get sensationalized in the West versus what you're actually experiencing on the ground? Because I've read about, like, you know what I'm going to bring up right now, that the whole construction project that got stopped because of the elves and things like this. But what's
right?
Can you explain that and what's really going on? Like, what is, do 50% of Icelanders actually truly believe in elves, and or is it is this a way in which we grapple with this conflict of us coming to terms with nature and the unknown?
Yeah, it's interesting. I get regularly. I do several interviews a year with journalists who come in search of the Icelandic belief in the elves. And of course they're not elves as we see them, which is a small little fairy figures. They're the Icelandic sense of the Álvar, or the hidden people, the huldufólk, is that they look just like us. They're just, a lot more like Hollywood stars than most normal people. But what I say to them is, yeah, okay, it's not that Icelanders are dancing around a rock every Friday evening or something, but little with little people out there. It's part of the way that they look at things. But what I find is more interesting is why they're in search of this, and why they're latching onto this. And in a sense, they're searching for the magic of their childhood, in a sense. Fox Mulder in the X-Files years back had a poster on his wall which said, "I want to believe," a beautiful poster. And in a sense, there is a longing to believe, a longing for the sense of magic that education has removed from them to a certain extent, for good or for bad. And when they come into Iceland, they're reaching back for something that they feel that they've lost from their own countries. Of course, their own countries had this at some point in the past. But you go to Western Ireland or you come to Iceland, and yeah, the people do still believe in nature spirits. And it's not strange. It's just part of the way that they see the world. It's part of, connected to their religious belief in many ways. It's a sense of what we just talked about in terms of nature being alive and a force that you don't fight, but you have to work with. You don't try and dominate it because you can never dominate it. So you depend on its goodness, in a sense, what it's going to allow you to work with. So yes, that's what they're coming here in search of, something new, something magical from that they've lost.
Yeah, and it's a shame, right? We all should have more magic in our lives. I mean, why not, right? Like it's better to live in a world of full of imagination and acceptance that you don't know everything, but also one which respects nature as something that you coexist within, that you can't overpower, like you said, right? And that's something I really felt in Iceland. Now, switching to a different phase of this a little bit, okay, what got brought into Iceland is one thing, but now what emanates out, you mentioned Tolkien, but I've also heard you talk in different interviews about things like Halloween or Christmas or, you know, other things that have made their way into, you know, different cultural spheres. that we might take for granted. You know, I live in California. Am I celebrating certain traditions in a Western culture that actually have their roots in Iceland that I don't even know about? Like, what are the kind of things that made their way out into our modern consciousness that we have lost connection to in their roots?
Well, so you mentioned both Halloween and Christmas, and of course, if we leave out cookies for Santa Claus, in a sense, this is the remnants of a sacrifice to nature spirits in the past at Christmas time, when people used to leave out whole tables full of food for the spirits when they visited the farmhouse at Christmas time. And in the past, it was a way of, an agreement that you were making with the spirits outside, that you give them something, they'll give you something back. But if we go to, let's start with Halloween. Halloween, as it is in the States, has particular roots in Ireland and the Gaelic world. It was a festival called Samhain, which is the beginning of the winter. So there used to be two seasons in the year rather than four. People thought about it in two seasons, and Icelanders still do to a certain extent. And winter came first. That's something that's a little bit new to us, the idea of winter coming first and the idea of night coming before day. And the remnants of that are the importance of New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve, the evening before. And Iceland still begins Christmas at 6 o'clock on Christmas Eve. That was the beginning of the Christmas day, if you understand what I mean, in the old days. So winter comes before summer.
Why would they celebrate Christmas? I mean, Christmas is a Christian...
Christmas, absolutely. But Christmas is also the turning of the seasons. The shortest day of the year, 21st of December. There were initially, in the Old Norse world, four festivals a year. You celebrate the beginning of the year and around Halloween and the winter nights, the night when winter starts. Then you have midwinter, when you hope that the sun's going to start coming back up again, when the seasons change.
Christmas.
And yeah, exactly. And then you have the beginning of summer, and you're celebrating that, the arrival of summer. And then you have midsummer. And we have a whole range of festivals for midsummer, which are usually around 21st of June, really. And those festivals were all turned into Christian festivals. We hear about it in the sagas again, which say that a certain king changed the winter nights into All Hallows Mass and changed the midwinter festival into Christmas, and midsummer is into St. John's, and then you have Easter. So yes, it's the church was sending out a message.
Did it exist in parallel? I mean, did Christmas exist before? Of course, it existed before these Icelandic stories were written down. But what, in terms of a tradition around that date, what was first?
It's pre-Christian, but everywhere. It's when the year stops getting short and starts getting longer, when the sun starts coming up again. You're celebrating the return of the sun.
This whole idea of leaving food out for to appease the nature spirits. I've heard you talk about there's actually like a kind of demonic woman who comes down on Christmas
right.
And eats the kids that aren't good or something. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So in Iceland nowadays, Christmas is represented by this ogress Grýla, who lives up in the mountains, and she's the one who eats children raw sushi if they don't behave themselves. And she's accompanied by 12 and she's accompanied by 12 Christmas lads that come down one by one in the 12 nights before Christmas, and then go back one by one in the 12 nights after Christmas until 12th night. And they bring down, nowadays they bring down presents. Initially, they would have received something. Their names suggest that they're being given sausages and meat and skyr and things of this kind. So one of them's called Sausage Swiper, another one's Door Slammer, another one's Window Peeper.
So these are the kind of mischievous...
Mischievous now, but more something slightly more frightening. And this is a mixture of, on one side, folk beliefs, which represent, in a sense, the darkness coming down and taking over the farmhouse and then moving away again as the year starts growing again, represented by the spirits. But also in the Nordic countries, then groups of people would dress up in costumes and come round farms at that time and be frightening for children, a sort of goat figure wearing skins. We hear about the Krampus, for example, the films of the Krampus in Austria and Germany, sort of horned monster-like figures. And that was the same all over Norway and Sweden and Denmark, and Iceland had the same thing. So these are
terrifying.
People enact the arrival of these spirits from nature, in a sense, taking back their land at Christmas.
Well, so two questions. Do you have a picture of the horn thing anywhere? And the second question is, what were these lads called again? What are they called?
The Yule lads. Yeah, and in Norway, it's the Christmas goat, the Julebukk.
Is it the same Yule as Yuletide? What is Yuletide?
Yes, exactly. So Yuletide comes from this. Yuletide is the old English, old Norse word for Christmas. And tide from teeth, which means time.
Okay, so you're just completely blowing my mind right now. That the celebration that I thought was like, okay, you know, Christmas, we get some little presents under a tree and all this other stuff. They actually originate far before Christianity in old pagan beliefs. Is that right?
It seems to be old traditions of the dead visiting at Christmas time and trolls visiting and moving in. Yeah.
And it has more to do with the fear of the sun not coming back than anything else. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's getting darker and darker. And in Iceland, in midwinter, I would say starts getting light at 10:30 and then starts getting dark again at 2:30. And from where we have out of our window here, you see the sun just sort of pop up and it starts going down again almost immediately. The opposite of what's happening at the moment.
It's going to be so hard.
On the other side. Yeah.
I mean, it's got to have a psychological toll on you, right?
Absolutely. And in a sense, so the darkness physically approaches. The snow physically comes down the mountains in on us. And in Norway, in some places, they didn't dare go outside at Christmas because it was felt that there were spirits around everywhere. So, in a sense, the natural landlords are taking their land back and they would like some payment. And this, to a certain extent, is what we're doing with Santa Claus and the cookies still at Christmas time.
It's better than what's her name again? The one that eats children like sushi?
Yeah, Grýla. What's particularly interesting about Grýla is that, like in Ireland as well, and like in Norway, where you have another figure who leads these, the wild ride of the dead onto the farms, they're all women. And this brings us back again to the world of the dead being led by a female figure. And this has led me to sort of raise this suggestion that maybe the year was divided into two, for some people, because Halloween initially in Scandinavia was a festival of nature, female spirits, and the Disablot, as they were called, Disid, family, female spirits, mothers of the families, and midwinter is ruled by a female figure, and we hear also about an end of the year, an end of winter festival where it's also related to women. So, and of course, wintertime was when everybody finished doing farming in the fields. They moved into the farmhouse, and that was the space ruled by women. Women held the keys. They were in charge of the house. They knew about, in a sense, the darkness as being a period of life going on in the womb of the earth. To a certain extent, it's all very female. And one can understand, it explains maybe certain myths, why often we have gods looking for their wives or disappear for a while, when you want them. So gods going away and coming back, maybe we have this idea in wintertime, the male gods are away, and in the summertime, the female gods are away. goddesses are away, something like this.
Who wrote these sagas? So for, like, when I hear about, for example, the Song of the Seers, which is the origins, one of the main origin Eddas, was it written and composed by, well, nobody knows who.
I don't talk about composition. These poems are under construction, I think is the best way to put it. Poems are usually said to be composed by men. But in the case of the Song of the Seeress, if it is a man, we have a man acting a woman. And women were often associated with having the power of prophecy rather than men. It's something that's natural to them, to them and the goddesses. Again,
oracle.
It's a sort of oracle. Same with the Sibyls, as you.
So how was there any, influence of story? Why is it that, for example, you have the Oracle of Delphi, a female prophet existing on a tripod of gold, resonating ideas of ancient, Greece. And then here in a completely different land, you've got the song, the Seeress. What can you describe her? Well, who was she? She was
she's seen as an oracle, and the sagas talk about these women who would go around, and at the beginning of winter, again the female festival, beginning of the year, they would prophesy. They are like the three Norns in the poems who sit at the bottom of the tree by a well and prophesy. Again, prophecy is all in the hands of women. Men are trying to learn it. Odin is trying to learn it. But it's natural to women.
What did she prophesy? What did she tell
us? She describes the end of the world, the creation of the world and the end of the world. She covers the whole period of mythological history. And the other ones will talk about, are you going to survive the winter or not? This is what people want to know. But it does seem to be within Western civilization, this idea that women have more supernatural power. Certainly our modern folk belief survey in Iceland of 2,000 people, women are much more open to the idea of ghosts and spirits and prophecy and things of this kind, and that they are also much more open to admit that they think dreams tell you about the future, and that you can see the dead and life after death. It's all, women are always much more than men. It may be that men are frightened of admitting this, but we don't really know why.
Okay, so just getting back to the prophet, the prophecies of the oracle of the Norse, who would be referred to as the Seeress. The end of the world is Ragnarok, right? Is that what it is? Is that what she describes?
Yeah, exactly.
What happens at Ragnarok? For those of us who don't know,
basically everything collapses. Brothers fight brothers, sisters fight sisters. The sun is swallowed by a wolf. The stars fall out of the sky. The earth burns up. Odin is swallowed by a wolf. The god Thor is killed by the middle of sea serpent. They kill each other. And the god Freyr.
Midgard.
Midgard just comes to an end. The world and the world sinks beneath the sea, sort of a few bubbles left, steam coming up as it goes into the water. And then, as the poem is, when it's recorded, and we don't know if that's from a later development, it comes back up again. Now, with that poem, as I've underlined before, it's a very male world, and I think it's created in the milieu of a sort of barracks of soldiers, male soldiers, around the Norwegian king. And they are people for whom battle is pretty central.
I mean, a lot of these stories seem very, they seem like they're basically, they seem like a male perspective story, a lot of these.
Absolutely.
Ones that you describe, right?
Exactly.
But this Song of the Seeress is a recording of the poetic Eddas, from the poetic Eddas, of her describing our creation and our end. And then you said at the end, you just kind of threw it out there, but what happens at the end of Ragnarok? Does everything come back?
The sea, it rises out of the sea, And then the sons of the old gods take over. And in this poem, as at the beginning of the poem, it's only men again. The women haven't come in and started getting involved. Right at the end, in one version of it, we've got Christianity coming into it. We have a sort of a high one comes down and judges everybody. And this is the arrival of the Christian God in one version. So that's why I say it's under construction. It's passed down in the oral tradition for 300 years. So, of course, it's going to change slightly.
And now today, I mean, the reason why I was so fascinated by all this is because these stories, elements of these stories are now in a lot of the things that we take for granted, like I said before, right? You have Halloween, you have Christmas, you've got, but then I remember, I remember sitting there and watching these fantastic stories of magic in Harry Potter with my kids when they were really young, right? And I mean, who doesn't love a little magic with Harry Potter? But he's got giants, he's got elves, and he's got trolls. And these are just sort of fantastical images of beings that you take for granted as just, okay, this is where these kind of epic dramas might bring us in our imagination. But when you're in Iceland and you feel this connection to nature, you feel like you're not at the center of the universe. You're not like humans are not like the main show when you're standing on a piece of land that's literally rumbling underneath you and you can feel the heartbeat of the volcano, right? Now, I just wanted to go back to something you said at the beginning to get us near a little thought here. You said, okay, the Viking ships, they showed up with dragons on the front of their on front of their boat. Now, I read through my friend and story producer, Bear, who you've met, Anthony Bear. He told me that he found this bit of research that said that the first law, that the Vikings, when they first showed up, they created this meeting called the All-Thing, right? The All-Thing, this is where we meet and make all the laws. And that the first law was no more dragons on the front of our boats because we don't want to offend the nature spirits on the island. Is that true?
Right. Yes, we have a remnant of three clauses from a very early law. And one of them is absolutely that. Exactly. You must take off the dragon heads from your ships so you don't frighten away the nature spirits because we need them. But that also underlines why they've got the dragon heads. Yeah. So why have they got the dragon heads on the ships? To protect them at sea. That's the point, to frighten away other spirits at sea. But you must take them off when you come to land because you need the land spirits. So that was one of the,
And that's what I love about it is that it's not a, hey, let me go slay the dragon. It's, hey, let's take care of our dragon to make sure that it stays with us. You know, it's a very different way of thinking about the nature spirits as being something that we're fighting against rather than something that we want to be protected by.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting, sort of these days, we're doing a lecture on this later this summer. That poem is being referred to by so often in drama these days. They're a drama and music. Jethro Tull recently have just given out an album where they are quoting that poem. There's a very powerful Norwegian band called Vardruna, which many of your listeners, I think, will know about. They sing Völuspá, the prophet of the CRS as well. Theater presentations have been put on in many countries, Germany, Norway, Sweden, Iceland in the last few years, which center around this poem, underlining that it has a lot to say to us today, warning us about we need to be very careful and that the world is in danger of burning up, which is the end of the poem. So it underlines that this poem has a lot of resonance within our own time and stays alive.
I feel like this hour flew by. And there's got to be more. The next time I talk to you, I do want to hear, I would love to hear, because you did research, you said, in other folklore ecosystems and cultural spheres, like with the Native Americans and and all sorts of see. I mean, the whole idea of folk stories and seeing whether or not there's certain elements that connect across folk stories is something I'm very interested in, because it's like, well, where do we have these shared memories? Where do they start from? Do they start from before our Great Migration and like all these other things? I don't know. Have you just in a few seconds, have you found connections across these different cultural stories?
I think it's yes, absolutely. Folk tales, yes. There's a lot of legends that we call migratory legends that you find all the way across from Germany up into Iceland. And we even have Greek myths that are occurring in Norwegian folklore in later time. They haven't been borrowed in writing, but they're ancient stories that have been passed. So the folklore,
also, but like globally, like when you, yeah, you know, we see the flood story show up so many different times in so many different cultures. Is there stuff like that you bumped up against, which is so universal? Like what are the most universal stories in folklore?
I think the mention of flood certainly is that. One wonders that they talk about which are these stories created, maybe from a shared element of DNA in a sense, created separately in different places, or are they like Indo-European? We talk about the Indo-Europeans' connections, which could run all the way through from India through all the way through Europe, on into Ireland on one side and Iceland on the other. And these same stories have passed. The figure of Thor, for example, you find in the Indian Indra. We have Zeus, we have Jupiter, we have, it's exactly the same figure when we come down to it.
Did you say that there's a Thor in the Indian, can you say that again? Wait, what?
I don't mean Native American Indians here. I mean India.
No.
Yes.
India. Yeah. Like in Hinduism or yes. Where? In what philosophy?
Yeah, and the figure of Indra is a thunder god, basically, and has a sort of hammer in the same way you certainly see. Yeah, and of course, and the white supremacists need to get over it, but the idea of the swastika comes from ancient India and is a sun symbol for positive. Yeah, ancient ideas that pass.
The opposite.
Of course, yeah, it's the same. It's the same image, and we have shared things within our cultures, and they link us, and tell us a little bit to get over sort of battles between each other. We need to realize that we share.
It's a beautiful poetic way to think about the fact that we share these stories and to get over our tribalism. But do you have any insights or thoughts about why we could come up or share stories across such different cultures and across such different timelines in such different regions?
Nobody really knows, because we're thinking like Polynesia, for example, or going into the Native American peoples. It's very difficult to say the element of the flood. Everybody's aware of tides going up, land being covered with water, and then land appearing. And in a sense, anybody taking a ship to Iceland would have seen the land come out of the water and the land sinking as they leave Iceland later on. So these are quite natural aspects. The idea of the sun coming up is going to be shared by everybody. The star constellations, we all share. We need to find a way of explaining them. So similar stories will be brought up, often relating to us dealing with animals in one way or
nature,
another.
Or the seasons.
Or
right?
Just like nature, actually, exactly, the world around us. Exactly. So there's an element of humanity, shared humanity, which again should bind us a little bit better than it does. And especially with climate change at the moment, there's a particular reason for underlining shared humanity. We're compared to the gods we talked about at the beginning, we're very small little creatures, and the powers that we're dealing with out there. which you were experiencing, yeah, of course, as you stood in the river, Iceland.
Oh God, I stood. Remember that I stood there for about an hour, 2 hours in a glacier.
Yeah, I saw you recovering from that. Yeah,
that's all coming out really soon. Man, that was such an incredible shoot. Okay, well, you know, first of all, I'm really grateful for your friendship and for the time that we spent together in Iceland. But maybe you want to end us with, give us the ancient Viking words of that story that's resonated so much. The warning call. What is it? Ragnarok.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see if I can remember this. So I mentioned at the beginning of the poem is very soft, and it has this sort of sound of lapping waves and shores and no hard sounds at all. And then you get this description of everything chaos coming about, which is something like this. So, Bræðum munu berjast og börnum verðast munu systrunga sifjum spilla. Hart í heimi, hordómur mikill. Skeggöld, skálmöld, skildir klopnir, vindöld, vargöld, áð veröld steypist. So at the end of it, you can hear the sort of hound dog in there. You can hear the sound of weapons clashing. And if we go on to, and Bræðum munu berjast, brothers will fight with each other. And then we get the wolf at the end, which is, So geir garmur mjög fyrir gnípa hedli, festur mun slitna en freki renna, fjöldveitun fræða framsi ég lengra, Ragnarök hramsig tífa. And again, the growl all the way through as the wolf has been set free to loose onto the world, to swallow the sun, to swallow Odin, and the sort of howling of this hound, which is leaping out onto the world, this massive, massive wolf. So yeah, it's got music in there.
Then the rebirth. You got to leave us with the rebirth, although there is no hope. Leave us the hope at the end.
Yeah, well, I don't know that one off by heart, but certainly, Sérun uppkoma. It begins something like Sérun uppkoma öðrusinni jarð úr ægi. So she sees it come up a second time out of the sea, but again, it's all very soft. Again, it's back to certain soft sounds. And certainly, as I say, for the sound of it, listen to the work, to the music of Vardruna, who are making use of medieval instruments and Icelandic poetry. It's spelled Vardruna. And this is a Norwegian band. And Einar from Norway knows his Icelandic very well. And the heart of his work is this work, the Song of the Seeress. Which he's presented using Bronze Age instruments and a harp. And when he wants to, a song about a rune on ice, he's playing on a glacier, for example. It's very, very powerful music.
Maybe a final thought from you, as a person who studied the ancient stories of the Norse and elsewhere, is there anything you want to leave us with as a nugget of wisdom brought to us from the ancient voices?
I think at least if the experience of bringing to life the sounds of these poems, bringing these poems back to life again, in a sense, it's the voices of these long, long dead people and gods to a certain extent, telling us to be aware of the power of nature that's around us, and that we need to be sensible and think, at least before we go dashing through doors too quickly or saying things too quickly, too stupidly. We need to stand there, listen to the music of nature, watch the turning of nature and changes of nature, and realize that we're actually quite small, and that we need to work with each other and work with nature. Would that do?
Beautiful. Profound. Timely, but also ancient and universal.
It's a bridge. These poems are a bridge. Been wonderful talking with you, and I hope we get a chance to meet again at some point. So be careful with these big fish out in the sea when you're out there.
Yeah, I cut my thumb. The fish bit my. It almost bit my thumb off yesterday. But yeah, I will, and I'll come back and tell some good tales. Thanks, Terry. It's good seeing you.